Welcome to Off Message. I'm Isaac Dover. Our guest today, Congressman Dave Bratt, who represents area around Richmond, Virginia. But that's not why most people know him. Most people know him because he made history in 2014, beating Eric Cantor, then the House Majority Leader, in a primary, the first House Majority Leader ever to lose a primary, and lost it despite having a 40-to-1 money advantage, a lead in the polls that everybody thought was impenetrable, and no expectation from anyone that he was going to win. Bratt came in as a Tea Party star, but also a representative of something that seemed to be going on in the country more than most people had tapped into, and that, in fact, seems like, when you look at what happened with Donald Trump, was ahead of his time. We talked about that. We talked also about him being the main agitator, one of the main agitators on the pushback on the House Republican plan for Obamacare repeal. Now, of course, he is a House Republican. He's a Tea Party member. He is a former economist. He talked a lot about how all of those things come together in his mind. We talked about if Paul Ryan and Donald Trump are conservatives by his definition. Spoiler alert, he's not super impressed with either of them at the moment. And you know what else? We talked about Nietzsche and his larger sense of what's going on with ethics and philosophy in this country. So we got a little deep toward the end. Stay in for that. It's worth it. But as much as we talked about Obamacare, the truth is that there's a person at Politico who knows it much better than I do. So you want to listen to Pulse Check, the other Politico podcast hosted by Dan Diamond that is out there covering these issues in depth, in detail, whether it's about what's actually in the policy and how it's taking shape or some of the maneuvering around the politics going on. Dan will get you up to speed with what's happening every week as it's going on. Remember to subscribe on iTunes and rate us or on whatever platform you like to get your podcast from, and follow me on Twitter at Isaac Dover or on Facebook, or email me at Isaac@Politico, 1S2As, and let me know who you want to hear on, any other thoughts you have, feedback, questions that you want to have answered, and we'll get to it. And now, Congressman Dave Bratt. You used to teach.
Yep.
If you were telling your students about the last couple of days, couple of weeks of this, what would you tell them? How would you tell them about what's going on?
Yeah, no, I'm glad I taught economics, right? And some people think that by definition is ideological or whatever, but there's not really much alternative to free market economics. I mean, that's what we teach is markets, right? Supply and demand curve. And so I would just get into the economics of it, right? And so in every market under the sun for every good, or if you just look at an intro micro book, you've got kind of the four basic models, right? Monopoly is the worst outcomes, and perfect competition is kind of utopian thing that's in fiction land a little bit. It doesn't exist in the real world, but it results in theory in the lowest price and best quality and highest quantity. And monopoly is the exact opposite, right? It's all the worst outcomes in the book. And in the middle, you got monopolistic competition and oligopoly. And so I just say, let's look at healthcare, right? Where does that fit? And what kind of outcomes would social science predict? Which I'm kind of glad you asked the question because, right, I mean, the last thing you ever hear up here is social science. I mean, and I could tell you my grad school jokes in certain rooms around campus, and you can be creative on which rooms you might think. We had science that said the social sciences are neither, right? So that's the joke, right? Yes. The social sciences are neither. But
I was a humanities guy, so I don't
know. I went to seminary, so I'm half humanities. And then I did a PhD in economics, right? And say, but we do the best you can, and there's no better, right? So Milton Friedman and all the latest and greatest say you put out the best hypothesis you can, you try to falsify it, and whatever's left standing is the best theory you have. And so economic theory, when you address it to healthcare, and you look at the design, and Milton Friedman would have said, when you aim at a policy target, hit it, right? And the problem with healthcare is we don't even know what the target is. And so right now, when it comes to the House bill, there's a few targets that we got to hit, and we're not really aiming at any of them.
Are you amazed? I mean, we've been talking about Obamacare repeal for a long time.
Yeah.
For longer than you've been in Congress.
Yep.
That we are sitting here today and you say we still don't know what the target is. Is that just amazing to you?
Yeah, it is amazing.
Whose fault is that?
Well, it's politics. And that's the problem, right? Politics is dominating policy. So you have one group, 5% of the population has pre-existing conditions, and accounts that 5% of people accounts for over half of the costs. So, and that's not an insurance problem. They can't get insurance. No one will cover them economically, right? So there's kind of a market failure, right? And you won't get me to say that too often, right? But that there's a market failure where we have to step in with a safety net and welfare policy. And so we need, that's the target, right? So you need to help these people and hit that target. But then you don't want that logic to overwhelm your macro theory on healthcare. And you don't want that logic to apply to 300 million people, right? So then you want to put pure competition in play for hospitals and insurance companies and the healthcare market, et cetera. And so we're not doing that. My big talking point the whole week has been the insurance regulations are the key piece that are driving the costs up. And so Obamacare, when it was initiated, paid almost sole attention to coverage, right? The insurance guys walked into the White House looking at their shoes, kind of embarrassed. And 8 years later, we're in a death spiral. That's why they were looking at their shoes, by the way, right? They knew the system they had designed didn't meet Econ 101 logic. So now we're in a death spiral, and I think we're about ready to make the same mistake. Everyone's focused on coverage. The CBO is all about coverage. You just heard the Democrats, it's all about coverage. And no one holds them accountable to Econ 101. The prices are going up 25%, right? I mean, that's just the on average. So how do you fix that? Well, you've got to get people shopping. And it's not all, you know, bad intent. After World War II, we did the employer-based healthcare. That was a huge distortion and a mistake. But now it's embedded, so going after that politics is very difficult. But that basically you gave a tax-preferred treatment to the employer-provided care, pre-tax, right? So the person gets compensation in the form of healthcare, and then you got a $30 copay, and you go into the doctor and pay your $30, and everything else is free. Right? The marginal cost is zero. Well, guess what happens when the marginal benefit is high and the marginal cost is zero? You consume a lot of stuff, and that's what's wrong with healthcare, right? So we've gone that model, and this is very fixable, but the politics kind of dominates the logic lately.
But we're 2 months into the new administration. We have a Republican majority in the House, a Republican majority in the Senate, a Republican president who said over and over again how committed he was to Obamacare repeal.
Right.
How are we still so far in your mind from there being a solution to this?
Right. Well, there's a lot of competing and conflicting policy objectives, right? The president wants to cover all people in some way, and we want to bring down costs, and we want to have competition across state lines. Right. And it's very hard to achieve that, right? And so that's what we're trying to sort out right now. And but just going with the fundamentals there, I think the key is most of us have in mind the promise we made, repeal and replace. And it started off 8 years ago, just repeal. And then it was repeal and replace with free market outcomes, right? And now it's repeal and replace with the basic structure of Obamacare. I got the National Journal right over here this morning, the front page article, a conservative theorist and a liberal theorist from the think tanks both agree that the primary architecture of Obamacare remains in place in our bill, right? And so that's those of us who are opposed to it, that's why we're opposed, right? We don't want that fundamental federal architecture.
Speaker Ryan said this was the plan that we ran on last year, and people have been a little bit confused of what he means by the plan, since the plan seems to be changing. Was the mistake not being more ready to go, not having this debate last year or sometime before 6-7 weeks into the presidency?
I think we've been talking about having regular order. This really wasn't regular order, right? And just in terms of eighth grade civics class, how do you know what common sense is? Well, he had a better way of agenda, and Rand Paul's got a bill. And in eighth grade civics sense, you'd want a debate on the floor, right? The old kind of mile of great spokesmen standing up and debating each other. My bill's better. That never happened. We have never had a debate between competing ideas. It was kind of the better way agenda, which laid out kind of bullet points. But it did not contain a lot that's in that bill. Right, and that's what's causing a lot of the heartache.
So what's your level of confidence at this point that we're going to have a bill that passes? You're shaking your head.
No,
there's not going to be a bill that passes the House and passes
not
the Senate.
Not this one. Right. I don't even think it's close. So
will there be a bill that gets to the president's desk that he signs that does anything that you feel like is significant in terms of Obamacare repeal from what you've seen so far?
Yeah, I think so. I think they want to get to yes. And I think they know the primary impetus has got to be on keeping your word, right? So the repeal side. So the moderates now in the Senate especially, I mean, they want everything, right? Medicaid expansion, increase tax credit, increase everything. Well, that's not the promise we made, right? We never said repeal and increase everything under the sun, right? So that, I think, when you go back to your base, and there, I hope we don't forget our base, but no, we'll get there. And it, basically the answer is if you put bucket two, right, the insurance regs that Tom Price is going to work on as secretary in the bill, and then you run into this Byrd rule nonsense, which we can overcome, I think, fairly easily. And I'm not saying it. We talked with the national experts on that Byrd rule stuff. And it's Pence gets in the chair, and the parliamentarian counsels you, and then the chair says, thank you very much for the counsel, let's vote, right? And the Senate is, based on what I just told, what they want, they're using that as a block.
But Pence in the chair only matters if you're at 50-50, and there are more than you've got a 3-seat Republican majority in the Senate. There are more than three Republican senators who are on the fence here about this. Right?
Well, and some of it has to do though with the he serves as the chair of the Senate, and so back Mike Lee talked on this last night a little bit. But the reason we're at where we're at on the 2015 repeal bill, that's the part we're insisting on, right, that we want to see as the baseline. And that was a compromise package that came out 2 years ago and dealt with the Byrd rule. But the reason they had to reach that compromise was because Biden was in the chair.
Right.
And it didn't have to do with a 50-50 vote. Okay. It has to do with he's the chair, right? And so there's some complexity with it. But it's
all the parliamentary rules.
Right. And just so people know out there, the criterion – for overcoming the Byrd rule is just that it has to have budgetary impact. And so, I mean, everybody in their right mind knows the insurance regs have a huge impact on the budget, for real, right? And Paul Ryan's even arguing that we're having, after 3 years, we finally get the price to come down 10%. And guess what drives that 10% price reduction? We got rid of the platinum, gold, silver thing. That's a regulation.
I mean, I remember the week after the election talking to some of the Obama folks who said, you know what? If they want to change, make a couple of tweaks to it and keep Obamacare, that's fine.
Right.
And call it whatever they want. Obama himself said stuff like that.
Right.
I went out to Chicago for that farewell speech that Obama did.
Yeah.
Afterwards, one of the people who'd worked on Obamacare said to me, I will bet you money they don't repeal Obamacare. And now in these last couple of weeks, the Democrats, they are giddy, basically. They think you guys are killing each other.
Right.
So – is there going to be, you really think there's a bill that will make you happy that the president will sign?
It's not going to ever make me totally happy, but I get the nature of this thing, right? And so the key for me, you started off with the economics, that's got to be what's there. You've got to have, you can have the central government come in on the welfare side, on the safety net side, on the pre-existing conditions issue, block grants to the states, and funding is not, we're not squabbling about that, which is unique, right? We're willing to give up quite a bit there if you give me that free market logic going forward on healthcare for 300 million people. Right. The whole country, there's no way I can, right, I'd be sued for malpractice having taught economics, right? I mean, it would be malpractice for me to sign off on a bill that doesn't have that market logic. And everybody back home knows what I ran on. I mean, I ran on Adam Smith and James Madison. That's what I ran on. And so they're going to say, and you're voting for, right? They know who I am. So I'm not close until we get that logic in place.
And so, I mean, what happens if there's not a repeal, right? You say, don't forget the base. What's the consequence of that? If we get to a bill that either doesn't have enough support in the Senate so that it doesn't have sort of consequentially doesn't have enough support in the House and so it doesn't move at all or passes the House and doesn't get through the Senate.
Yep. Well, then the messaging just overwhelmingly is what's going to happen is Obamacare is in a death spiral. It's collapsing, and that collapse is going to continue, and Trump's kind of said it, right?
Yeah.
The cynical play is just to ride it out and show the internal logic of what they put in place. The car's in the ditch.
Yeah.
We didn't put the car in the ditch, right? So the car, and they'll have to message like crazy. Our side is not good at messaging, right? Trump is the first guy we got that's out there. He's
the
messaging.
Democrats always talk about how your side is much better at messaging.
Oh, really? That's
a surprise to you?
It's based on the last town hall I had, it's a surprise to me, right? I had red cards ablazing and booing after
was
20
that a
seconds.
Surprise? Like, having that
oh, yeah.
Kind of...
That was all brand new.
Yeah.
No one knew that was coming.
And do you feel like that's reflecting something that has changed about the politics in this country or
oh,
not?
The Democrats told me. I mean, we all get along personally, right? They're just – but they – the Democrat activists in my district, they said, we were asleep and we're ticked at ourselves. I mean, they just came out and said, we were sleeping, Trump won, we thought Hillary had it, and now we're ticked.
Right.
Right. So they're ticked at themselves. And so now they're just –
they're just going to take they're it out just, on you.
Oh, they're
like
right. It. I'm the – right. I'm the available guy.
So there are about 30,000 people in your district who use the tax credits for insurance.
Yep.
What do you say to them about the possibility of those going away?
What scenario?
Well,
under,
I mean, in any of the scenarios here, if that could be the way that this bill ends up moving forward, what do you say to those people?
I don't know what I'm talking about quite yet. I mean, we get rid of the tax credit, the refundable tax credit.
Yeah.
We're not necessarily opposed to that. It's how we just had an amendment in budget right now that said we got to make sure that those tax credits don't go to the higher income folks and they go to only to the population in need. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're talking about, right? The safety net part isn't the part that's in dispute. It's the refundable tax credits and then to able-bodied, right? The Democrats totally disagree. They just voted on another amendment right there. They said the idea of work requirements is repugnant and a put down to human beings. I totally disagree. I mean, I know everybody in the disability community across, they all want their kids mainstreamed in school and mainstreamed in the workforce. And so I don't know what the Democrats are talking about. I haven't met a person out there who doesn't want a job. And the idea of means testing, right, for able-bodied adults, I mean, if they want to have that debate, I'll have it all day.
I mean, I think one of the perspectives that it seems to me like you might have on this is your mother was a social worker, right? You know, some of these issues I'm sure were in your mind growing up and seeing from what she was doing.
Sure.
And how does that inform your perspective on how you go about doing this stuff?
Well, I'm an economist, and so I'm an efficiency guy, right? And so the first thing you do when you want to help the poor is you got to get them into the workforce. I mean, I'm a Calvinist, if that gives you any hint, right? So we got the whole work ethic thing. That's my background. And you don't have to be a Calvinist. The Chinese and the Indians, when I started teaching econ 20 years ago, made $1,000 each per person. Now they're at $10,000 because they went free market. So they just lifted 2.5 billion people out of poverty by using free markets. And we're moving away from free markets. And the burden is against me? Really? I mean, all the evidence I know of, right? Economic growth gets you everything you want. It gets you political rights, civil rights, women's rights, civil liberties, higher educational attainment, higher human capital, clean air, clean water. Economic growth gets you everything. And so I don't know how the other side debates and how we lose. That's what I'm talking about in the messaging war, right? In K-12, the teachers are kind of neutral on education and capitalism and business. Higher ed, they're antagonistic. Right, so we're telling young people what you do all day long, right, for 9 hours or 10 hours a day, is morally reprehensible. I mean, what a positive, uplifting message!
let me bring something to you that you said back at the end of January. Right? You got a lot of attention for this. You said the women are in my grill no matter where I go.
Yeah.
How has that shaped things? Did the women who are in your grill, did they win? Did they succeed in blocking this up and making this a much harder thing?
No, and that whole thing, the press, I mean, jacks that up, right? We're dealing with $1 trillion issues, and that is the news, right? So in the first, a constituent.
What do you say in my grill, I think.
Yeah, and I didn't even know what a grill was. The constituents told me that. They said, we're going to get in your grill. And I made the mistake of repeating that phrase, oops, because I thought it was funny. And you'll hear right out, everyone's laughing afterward. I never say a negative word about anybody, right? I went to seminary. And so for me, it's a joke. But then it went to the BuzzFeed, which you can get a sense from the BuzzFeed, right? I mean, it's a buzzsaw probably, and HuffPost. And then they view it, and then the Washington Post repeats it because they're left-wing fake news lately. And then all the local papers think, well, the Washington Post printed it, so you get the fake news thing. Yeah.
Because that's going around a lot.
Yeah.
What is fake news to you?
Yeah, fake news to me is when the Richmond Times-Dispatch, and since they have been very good, but they had a first couple stories in the Washington Post. I had 500 meetings with constituents over the past 2 years. Never an interview with any of these papers on my positive contributions that I think I've made, right? Maybe they disagree with me politically, but 500 meetings with constituents. And then the headline after Trump wins, 2 weeks in, where is Dave Brat? He can't be found. No one can find him.
And where is Dave Brat?
I know, going around the district, right? Up here working and voting. I mean, that's fake news, right? And so when I've been the guy on the fiscal stuff, the budget deficit, the $100 trillion in unfunded liabilities, I go out to the press corps after every vote. Most people run away from the press. They're scared. I go right into the press every day. And so fake news is when the narrative changes from Dave's everywhere, which is what my district knows to be true, and to the narrative changes to where's Dave? And then you're like, okay. I mean, and I don't have a big megaphone, right? You don't have a lot of money.
Because, I mean, and I'm speaking as a journalist here, of course, but so this is a sensitive topic.
Right, no. Don't do fake news.
Right? So the original fake news, like what that was politically deployed,
right.
Actually made up news.
Right.
And your problem is with news that you feel like is not taking into account the full picture of what's going on.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Pointed in a direction.
Right.
Right.
Right. And another example is the job of news. Right now, the opinion page is different. Right. If people want to hit me, that I've never, you can't complain about that. That's people's opinion. But on the news, if there's a piece on like healthcare, et cetera, people taking it to me on healthcare, that's fine. But they always give me the worst case scenario. What are you going to do about this particular individual in a terrible position after the car's already in the ditch, what we've been talking about, mm-hmm. right? And there's no context given about Obamacare and a death spiral in the article, right? So there's no 8-year historical context. And it's I'm supposed to solve the problem immediately for 300 million people. And so there's always kind of this bias of, well, what are you going to do about it? And I'm like, holy, that's a big project, right? And so that the news could really help by providing the context as to how we got here. And then, like, they weren't also reporting on the main alternative bills out there, the Cruz bill. What is it? The Price bill. What is it? What's Trump want? And that's what I'm getting. If the news would do that, and then they say, hey, we don't find your answer sufficient, that's fine. I mean, that's...
It's fair to say that you're not a fan of Obamacare as a...
Right, right.
So let me ask you, and I'm going to ask you sort of a worst-case scenario thing.
Yeah.
If you have the option of repealing Obamacare
yep.
or leaving it in place and as you think it's going to go into a death spiral,
yeah.
Which is the better option there if you guys can't agree on some kind of a replace plan?
Well, that's a hypothetical. I mean, and you said if what you... I'll answer your question.
Yeah.
I'll vote for the repeal. Right?
So it's better to be in the system that we had in 2009, right, than to let...
Oh, that way, right.
Right.
Just a repeal, you mean,
yeah.
Without a replace.
I mean, you are more confident than some
yeah.
That there is a replace bill that
right.
could get through that would be significant. So
yeah.
I guess it is a hypothetical,
right?
But it's a...
Yeah, no.
Hypothetical, sort right. of informed by where we are in these last
right.
couple
of years. Right. And so, I stick with it. I'd go with the repeal. And my emphasis is it's always better to start off with a free market foundation and then add on the safety nets, right, rationally and intentionally, rather than start off with a socialist framework, which has already shown itself to fail in every country through history, by the way, and the decline of nations. Every nation, there's one, it's corruption and cronyism and et cetera at the federal level, right? That's why nations fall apart, is due to federal government corruption. And so that all of our founders got that right, right? They had checks and balances. But now D.C., all the cranes are building in D.C., and everybody knows what's going on in the new Rome here, right?
There's a lot of building going on.
Yeah, a lot of building here, right.
There are one of the things that strikes me about what's going on is that there are a lot of people who call themselves Republicans these days. There are a lot of people who call themselves conservatives these
yeah.
days. Not everybody seems to agree on what that means.
Right, that's good. Right, right.
So to you,
yep.
what is in 2017, in this moment, what does that mean to be a conservative, to be a Republican, or to be maybe a conservative Republican?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got a book on it if your listeners have a hard time falling asleep. It's all right there, American Underdog, right? I mean, this isn't my thinking.
Right.
Conservatives really don't have an intellectual system, right? The Burkean notion is it's kind of an organic thing that's built up over long-term history. But the Judeo-Christian tradition, which gets you out of that, you get uniquely the rule of law and the liberal system, right? I mean, that's kind of the – right? Conservatives are now the owners of classical liberalism, Jefferson and Adam Smith and all that. And then after you get the rule of law, you get my guy Madison up on the wall there and Jefferson and the Virginians, and you get the separation of powers and the Constitution, 18 enumerated powers for the federal government. And then if you're really lucky, you get Adam Smith and free markets. Right at the end of the, and that is all one intellectual tradition, right? It's basically the synthesis of the Judeo-Christian tradition and Greek reason, right? In my town hall, I said that, and somebody said, "So you worship Zeus?" Just as what I got to deal with, right? Just to have a little humor along the way, right? I said, "Whatever, okay, moving on."
But do you worship Zeus? Let's just clear that up.
No, I'm a kind of a monotheist lately, right? I love the Greek stuff. I like all of whatever. But that's it. That's conservatism. It's that trajectory, right? 2,400 years that resulted in Madison and Jefferson. They said, what are you most proud of? What do you want on your tombstone? Not president, not head of UVA. They're most proud of their statutes on religious toleration. Unbelievable, right? I mean, that's what they're most proud of. They structured it. And as a conservative, it's kind of scary in the school. The kids aren't learning the basic grounding anymore, right? I tell kids, everyone says, well, there's a separation of church and state, and Dave Bratt's a Presbyterian, and he wants everyone to follow his religion. No. The First Amendment says no establishment of religion, but, comma, free expression thereof, right? And so it's both parts. It's worked very well. And along with that, our rights in this tradition come from God and precede government. And so the liberals at the town hall, I said that, and they – well, then get rid of rights, they shouted out. I'm like, really? That's where we are? I mean, then the liberals aren't liberals anymore, right? If that's the view, it's anarchy, because I'm basically a classical liberal, and liberal comes out of the root word liberty, right, which I'm a big believer in.
Do you think that Paul Ryan fits your definition of conservative Republican at this point?
Intellectually, that's why I need a lot of aspirin at the end of the night. He's trained in exactly like I am. He's Hayekian, Milton Friedman. He likes them. He's free trade, right? And Hayek's got a nice little idea called the fatal conceit. And the fatal conceit is to think that our little finite minds can do the mathematical calculations necessary to run an economy for 300 million people. That's the fatal conceit. And when it comes to healthcare, right, you got Texas and California, huge differences in product diversity, what they want, how much freedom they want, what they want their states to do. And we got a one-size solution that's going to fix that. No, I don't think so. So, yeah, that's why I get a headache, because I know Paul Ryan was trained in that, and then this is what the bill looks like. And I know what he wants.
But maybe not just on Obamacare, right? Do you think that he's been speaker for a while now.
Yeah.
Has he been governing, leading the House as a conservative Republican by your definition of it?
Well, I mean, he's got multiple hats on, right? He's head of the conference and the politics, and so you got a bunch of moderates and tough seats, and he wants to hold that together. And then he's got his policy theory where he probably agrees with me. And then those run into each other and collide when the policy conflicts with the politics. And right now, the politics is winning too much. And so I don't know if he's all in charge of that or the Senate's in charge of that. They're ducking a lot of this too. But that's the Tea Party movement was kind of, we're sick of this. Whatever is doing this, we're sick of it.
Right.
And we just want to get common sense back and have these conservative outcomes instead of a continuously expanding federal state.
You probably know where I'm going. What about President Trump? Is he a conservative Republican by your definition of it?
He is just a unique character. I mean, he's hard to define. He's kind of doing, the economic nationalism piece a little bit. He his list of issues is conservative. He came out of the gate with the big agenda package, which was repeal and replacement of Obamacare. And I think he had the normal common sense of repeal when he was campaigning. It wasn't repeal and replace with expanded tax credit. I never heard that. You know, I never heard the big, right? So when he's screaming it out and everyone's yelling down in Florida and wherever, I don't think they had in mind a bigger federal government. And then regulatory reform, and that you already see, the market's responding. So that's conservative. Getting rid of regs, and there's a whole host, but business already has a sense that the federal government's not coming after them anymore. And just lifting that fear, I think the markets feel relieved. And then third is tax reform. And he's going to lower the corporate rate. We're the highest. We're 35, 39 all in, down to 20. And Larry Lindsey, the Harvard economist that did the Reagan cuts, is estimating 4% GDP growth and 8% wage growth when we haven't had wage growth in 30 years. So, I mean, that's, I think, his number one piece, right? And so, I mean, that's JFK, Reagan, whatever. That's not partisan. JFK got tax cuts and got 5% real growth. So I don't think that's partisan. That's what's wrong with this city.
But the question I ask you is whether you think he's a conservative.
I think his agenda is conservative.
Yeah.
Yep. I mean, he's a New Yorker, big, high, I mean, he's, I mean.
Nothing wrong with being a New Yorker.
He's a Presbyterian on yeah. top of it, right? So, I mean, we'll see. We'll see how it all goes.
I'm going to bet that you have an easier time getting in touch with the Trump White House than you did with the Obama White House.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What are your dealings with like with them?
Not much yet because they've been ramping up. I mean, they've been putting everybody in. So they're all busy. I went over and saw Cohn, the economic advisor on our HSA healthcare stuff. And then, you know, we're listening to them, but I haven't been over yet. And that's part of, you know, once things settle down, I think you'll see a much more aggressive, you know, stance on policy with us working together. But they just got the secretaries their first meeting last week, right? And so that's what they've been doing. And so I wish we had more meetings on healthcare earlier.
Have you dealt with the president at all?
A little bit. He called last week, and I've talked to him on the phone. He came in and helped me in Virginia right at the beginning. He liked my race against when I had my big win.
Your big win.
Yeah, right.
Your big win, which to remind people who may not remember, you took down the majority leader of the House.
Yep.
And I think you were outspent 40-1.
Yeah.
You were so far down in the polls that most people were not even covering the race on the night of the primary. I will tell you, I'm going to admit a little bit about we had a story ready to go that was about what Eric Cantor, whom you beat, was going to do on immigration reform once he got through the primary with you.
Right.
That story never ran.
Right.
So everybody was taken by surprise.
Yeah.
And in this way, there are some parallels, right, between what you were able to pull off and what Trump was able to pull off.
Yeah.
You on a obviously smaller scale, it's a House race, but by tapping into something that was there that people weren't appreciating, by not doing it the way that most people thought.
Yeah.
And do you think of yourself that way? As like not the person who showed Donald Trump how to run for president, but as a parallel to what happened there?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not ego-driven. I think Trump and I both listened to the people. And so I taught economics for 20 years. Immigration wasn't one of my issues. I mean, going back 20 years to teach it, that, you know, it's not in the book. But then you start going around and meeting with people and you're starting to think about running for office, and you go around and talk to people, and then you start hearing about the issue, and you go, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? And what is the true economic impact? And what did Milton Friedman say about this?
What's the moment that ticks over to you to say, okay, I'm going to run for Congress?
Well, that's a bigger story. I mean, that's been my whole life. I did economics and ethics, right? My whole life was putting those two together. So I went to seminary and did a PhD in economics and worked at the World Bank and the Army and all that. And so that – and then I taught it, and I was always thinking about how do I do this, right? I mean, I don't want to just sit here and teach my whole life. I want to do some of this and put it in place. And so that was that. And then I started running for other positions in the state.
You remember State House, right?
And the cronies, I just saw every state would block you and bat you down, and I was getting sick of that. And so I was like, okay, there's one way to end that, and it's just go for the big prize.
The first race you ran was for what?
I was going to run for state senate, and I just kind of got the...
That was when they locked you out of the... right.
That was a delegate race. Right. It was a delegate race, right? And that one was blocked. So I was like, you know, what's wrong here? You know, everyone liked me, right? I mean, I knew all the heads of business, the lobbyists, everything, and it's all good. And then after I won, it's like, hey, you know, I believe in Madison and Jefferson and Adam Smith. I'm going to do free market. And that's what I taught. And they're like, Dave, it's all nice. You believe all that. It's all great. But you're not really going to do that, are you? And I'm like, yeah, that's the plan. Right. And so that's part. If you get in the way of the cronies, that's the new thing. And that's the Trump thing, too. Right. This cleaning the swamp thing. And the American people were just getting sick of it. So part of it is just luck, right? I mean, I ran at a time when that impulse was just huge, right? People were just sick of the elites getting special deals across the board. And that I ran right when that was happening.
And you surprised everybody, right? But
yep.
you did it. Why did it work for a congressional race and not for another race? The state senate race was an internal party process, and that's part of the difference. But why start with Congress and not?
Well, I think you're onto something there, and a part of it is the money. And the more local you are, you either have to be very well known and have some money and something ready to go. But on this one, what changes all of a sudden? I got some national media attention. And my own papers, no one would cover anything. And I was telling them, I said, I'm ahead. I was telling the papers in my region, locals, whatever, forever. I said, I'm 20 points up in every county. I said, I'm door to door. And they thought I was lying. I said, I went to seminary. I don't lie. And they were like, well, that's cute too, right? I mean, it's all funny. And so I was like, no, I'm not lying. I'm telling you the truth. I don't lie a whole lot. And they're like, okay. And that's what's wrong with our society. I mean, it's just everyone assumes that we lie. And we're electing, I guess, too many people that aren't believable.
Right.
And that's a problem.
There are a lot of politicians who do lie.
Yeah, right. And the press should light it up on that.
Well,
right?
I mean, some people, right, the joke about political journalism is that it's our job is to stand waiting outside of meetings and stick a microphone in front of people's faces for them to lie to us.
Right.
but with you handed me as we were right before we started a list of some of the money that's being spent against you and other people on the Obamacare thing. I imagine the experience you had in your race of being outspent by that makes it so that you don't pay a lot of attention to the ads that are being run against you.
No, I know. There's a group it's anti-Trumpers that are running ads for Trump, this AA, American Action Network or whatever. And it's got special interest money tied to healthcare. I think Karl Rove and there's some elites, right? The elites are the only one for the bill, by the way, right? The people aren't. I mean, it's amazing, right? The elites and the cronies are for – so they're running ads, and it's basically a pro-Trump, pro-my kind of ideas. And it says support President Trump, which most everybody thinks I do anyway. And it's got my name and picture there. And in my house race that I won, there's $5 million ads run against me, but
that's
it said
lot.
Dave Bratt.
Right.
For $5 million worth. And so I was like, thank you very much, right? I
went free advertising.
Aisle 3 of Walmart. Everybody knew me. I was like, okay.
Let me ask you one more thing about your race and sort of how it informs where you're thinking on things. People don't know exactly what to expect out of 2018, whether we're going to have a lot of primaries or the Republican Party fighting with itself or the Democratic Party fighting with itself or what it's going to be.
Yep.
What do you think – where's the Republican Party going to be going into the midterm year? Do you think that there should be the kinds of primaries that you ran? Aren't you the sort of touchstone for people to say you actually can win a total underdog race and you can be I think it's fair to say if Eric Cantor were still the seat that you represent, things might seem a little different right now. That you can make a difference in the way that even the whole course of legislation moves.
Yeah, well, it's hard. It's on the narrow aspect. When I came up here, all the guys were funny. The amazing thing, I get along with everybody personally, up to Democrats, right? We all work out in weight room and whatever, and we all get along. And they all said, thanks, Dave, right? And now what they are saying is I'm looking over my shoulder. And so mine was a shock, right? And so, but it's a good thing because now everybody is looking back at their constituents and saying, hey, I'm going to listen. So that's a net plus. So, you're going to have primaries and challenges, but this will be the touchstone, this Obamacare repeal. When you promise your base for 6 or 7 years, and it depends what your district looks like, right? Northern Virginia versus where I am or whatever are different. But that's a huge, right, piece is how you communicate with your constituents on those kind of issues. And so – and Trump said the day after I won, I think he said something like no one's safe. right? This shows you no one's safe, right? It's all up for grabs.
So there should be primaries if this is what it's going to be, right?
Well, yeah, I don't even like, you know, because if you say that, it has a certain meaning. But I don't endorse anyone. I didn't even endorse the president, right? And he's not happy with me about that.
He does keep track of who endorsed him.
No, he keeps track. I know. And I supported him. I handed out stuff. I worked hard for him. But I don't endorse in any election because I don't like cronies telling people who to vote for. And so I told the president, and he says, well, why did you tell me that ahead of time or whatever? You know, so he's funny.
And so the other day when Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan, wanted to take a photo with him, he pointed out, yeah, you can come in the photo even though you didn't endorse me.
Really?
I never forget.
Right.
Right? So I don't know. Maybe you won't get your photo with
him. No, he's got loyalty. He's a New Yorker, right? The loyalty thing, it's a big deal. And so I understand that. That's okay. But in the end also, what he learned is those don't matter. Endorsements don't matter. I didn't have any endorsements, and I won by 10. I didn't have an endorsement. And my competition had every endorsement. And
so without supporting or not supporting people doing it, do you think it's going to happen more? Are there going to be more people who are
Yeah.
You do.
I mean, there's already. The guys are telling me. There's primaries coming.
People are coming to you for advice?
No, I mean, I just hear my colleagues tell me. I got, you know, guys coming to challenge me and some da-da-da-da. So there's action on the left and the right.
Right. No, it seems among the Democrats, there's a lot of worry about ideological purity.
Right,
stuff, right,
same thing. Right, right.
I feel like we'll have busy primary seasons.
Right,
and busy general
I think
election
so. No, I think so.
Year.
Right.
So I will tell you, I was a philosophy major in college,
oh, good
and I do
for you.
Not usually get to talk about philosophy in the course of my journalistic career. I want to bring you back to something that got a little attention a little while ago, something you wrote in 2011, and I'm just going to read it because I don't want to mess it up. You're writing about Nietzsche.
Yes.
It's part of my undergraduate thesis, actually.
Really? Good.
This is what you wrote.
Yep.
Nietzsche's diagnosis of the weak modern Christian democratic man was spot on.
Yep.
You go on to write, Jesus made things happen. Jesus had faith. Jesus actually made people better.
Yep.
And then the conclusion of that thought is, Hitler came along, and he did not meet with unified resistance.
Yep.
I have the sinking feeling that it could all happen again quite easily.
Yeah.
You wrote that in 2011.
Yeah.
Where has your thinking evolved on that? Are we just as vulnerable?
Yeah. No, I mean,
is your sinking feeling further sunk?
Yeah, and it's not my idea. I mean, that's Plato's Republic too, right? I mean, he says it's the decline from, you know, the philosopher king to aristocracy, and democracy is the fourth. And after democracy, it's not Nietzsche's diagnosis. It's in some sense reality. Just democracy, right, without principle, right? So all democracy means, people think it means the government we have. It doesn't. All it means is majority vote. It's a majority vote without virtue. And Plato had a thing where a guy runs into an ass, a mule, and apologizes to the mule. I'm sorry, mule, right? Because everyone's equal, right? There's equal rights to the mule. And so if you descend in rationality to that point where you cannot think anymore, your civilization is crushed. And so, and that's the point. And Nietzsche said, you know, Jesus was the great-souled man. That was his thesis. I obviously disagree with Nietzsche's atheism, et cetera, just to make that clear to my listeners. But his diagnosis—
Not on board with the syphilis.
Yeah, I'm not on board with all the crazy part. But his diagnosis of Western civ, I'm saying, is spot on. We've become weak, and our kids don't know what human rights are anymore. And if you ask them, do you believe in human rights, civil rights, women's rights, civil liberties in class, I would ask people from every gender, ethnicity, everything, do you believe? And they would say, the common response from the 18-year-olds right now is, well, I have my opinion, but you're welcome to have your opinion. And then in a classroom setting, you mention tyrants like Hitler and other tyrants in history. And you say, what if they oppose you? Are they welcome to their opinion? In this modern secular society where all opinions are equal? Do you really believe all rights and all opinions are equal? And they say, well, I guess not. Well, I say, well, I guess you better study hard and pick a system that you like here, right? And there's no such thing as ethics. There's Aristotelian ethics or Kantian ethics or Confucian ethics or Jewish ethics. There's no such thing as ethics. And so that's what a liberal arts education is supposed to do. You're supposed to, I would always kind of play the part of whatever philosopher. And they wouldn't know what I thought, and I'd try to get them at least to like one system and then go on there from learn, right? And so, but they're not taught any ethics in K-12, And it's a fundamental problem we have with our culture right now.
It's 6 years since you wrote that.
Yeah.
Do you feel like we're further down the road?
Oh, sure. I mean,
what does that mean when you say that we're vulnerable to Hitler, essentially? Like, what does that mean for where we are as a society, where we are as a culture?
Yeah, well, we used to have these intermediating institutions, right? Tocqueville and these guys, when they came over, you had the church and the communities and your bowling league and the sports clubs and all that. We're losing that. And you got what's his name that from Harvard that wrote Bowling Alone,
Putnam,
and all this kind of stuff. And that, I mean, I just found myself squarely in that's where we have.
I guess what I'm asking, do you think it's a metaphor? Is the Hitler, or is it really like you're worried about a dictatorship tapping into the weaknesses that you think we have as
no, not. I mean, we're not there, but we cannot keep going down the path we're on, right? K-12, our education system. I think the Vietnamese, the bottom decile of Vietnamese outscored us. The bottom decile in ninth grade algebra, they outscored our average ninth grader. The PISA data just came out a month ago. I think I got that right. But it's standard.
I'm less up on that than on Nietzsche.
It's just standard, right? And so our K-12 system is teaching kids about isosceles, triangles, whatever, but the kid doesn't know what a business is when they graduate from high school. And if you ask them, what's your purpose in life? Do you have any purpose? And so we're making these kids memorize this stuff for their standardized test scores, and they're bored out of their gourd because they don't know why they're studying it. You say, in my tradition, why'd God put you here, right? What are you doing? Right? What goal are you pursuing? Where are your special talents and attributes? How are you going to use them, you know, to help society? And we're not teaching that because we're so PC and we're so scared to get it. Those questions will lead into truth claims. And that's what I'm scared of. If you no longer believe
that's,
in truth.
It's when we have these questions about fake news and all this stuff, it does seem like we're in that mix already. Right.
And that, right. If you don't know, I mean, Harvard's a motto at 1640, right? The oldest thing was truth for Christ in church. You think that's Harvard's motto anymore? Right now it's lucky if it's Veritas. And if you go into a brown bag seminar at Harvard or Yale or Princeton, they're all deconstructionists. If you mention the church or Christian doctrine or Jewish, they'll laugh you out of the room. If you mention natural law theory out of Aristotle, you'll get laughed out of the room. And that's what's going on at our highest levels. And they don't have a replacement, right? So Karl Popper, he had, you know, falsification, right? Okay, so we can't agree on a positive project of truth, you know, logical positivism. And so is there anything still standing? And on the left, right, conservatives, we say we have the Judeo-Christian tradition, and rough, you know, got Immanuel Kant, this kind of a secular compromise. And the Jews and the Muslims and the Christians all got along in the 12th century with Aristotle, right? They all agreed, let's do Aristotle's ethics. We'll differ on the religion, but let's just do Aristotelian ethics. What is the compromise today with the left? Right? They had their convention 4 years ago, and they booed putting God in the platform. Right? And so what are they left with? And that it's a challenge in time. And then on the right, if you believe in God, you're called a judgmental something these days for believing in the tradition that grounds our entire Western civ, which I find a little bizarre.
We're going to see a lot of this, I feel like, shape up in the budget fight over the course of the next couple months.
Right.
Your initial read on the budget that came out of the White House is positive or negative?
Well, that's the aspirational budget first, right? So that one is usually the cheerleading document. And then by the time you get to appropriations, you see the numbers and how it's actually going to work. And things will probably get plussed up beyond what that document says. So it's as an aspirational document, it's not blowing all the numbers across the board, which is welcome. But we'll see. It all depends. When we get to the 12 appropriations bills, we'll see what they look like individually.
All right. So last question here. You were a teacher. If you had to write a course name for your syllabus the last couple months of the have been, tell me what that would be.
Well, I'd throw in my Calvinism, of course, and total depravity just for the humorous part. But no, it's just it's the classics. This is the liberal arts education up here. I'd a cross-discipline view of politics and economics and culture and anthropology and everything.
But to describe specifically these couple of months, these first couple months.
Oh, just these couple.
Yes.
Oh, man, you can't make that one up. I don't know, a primer in chaos theory or something like that. I don't know. I mean, there are very few rules in place that we're all working from right now. I mean, it is wide open, right? There's a contest for what does the Republican Party mean. There's a contest for what's the Democratic Party. The independents and Bernie in the middle. There's a populism at play right now. The working class, the forgotten man is in right now. And so that's all new. We'll see where that leads. I mean, that's what's coming. And I don't think anyone's charted it out accurately yet.
All right, so Primer and Chaos by Professor Dave Brett.
Right, that's it.
Congressman Dave Brett, thanks for taking the time.
Yeah, anytime. Thank you.